I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The Postmaster General John Potter said last week that letter carriers delivered 170 billion pieces of mail in the last fiscal year. While that's a lot, the post office continues to lose money as more people use the internet to pay their bills, buy goods, and stay in touch with friends and family. Potter has proposed ending Saturday delivery, laying off more than 100,000 workers, and closing as many as 3,700 post offices. There are bills in Congress to reform and modernize the U.S. Postal Service, and there are questions about whether the agency's business model is still a workable one. Well, today on Radio Times, the future of the U.S. Postal Service, and we have two guests who have joined us. Richard Geddes is an associate professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell University. He served on the Council of Economic Advisors under the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, and he's the author of a book called Saving the Mail, How to Solve the Problems of the U.S. Postal Service. He joins us from the studios of Cornell University. And Richard Geddes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for inviting me back, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you back. Also with us is Stephen Greenhouse. He's the labor and workplace reporter for The New York Times, author of a book called The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. And Steve Greenhouse, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Very nice to be here, Marty. Thanks.
And Steve, if I can begin with you, and I do want to talk about how the post office is, in a sense, being threatened on a number of different fronts, but let's begin with the internet. Just how much has the internet eaten into the Postal Service's service? Steve?
Experts at the Postal Service, experts like Professor Geddes, say that the increased use of email, people able to read fashion catalogs or newspapers online, people paying the bills electronically, that has cut greatly into the use of the mail. Mail volume is down about 22%, has fallen by more than 30 million pieces a year from 5 years ago. So it really is making quite a big difference.
And Rick, if I can go back to you, one of the ways that the U.S. Postal Service has been able to make money, or at least provide the service, is that it has relied on first-class mail to fund its operations. If people are paying bills online or sending letters to each other online, what has happened to that first-class mail?
Well, just as Mr. Greenhouse said, Marty, mail volumes have been dropping steadily since 2006. So the drop in mail volumes actually predates the current economic recession that we're dealing with. And Mr. Greenhouse is right on the 22% drop in overall volumes. But there's even steeper drops in first-class mail delivery. And that's very important for the Postal Service because first-class mail is its most profitable mail class. In fact, it makes about three times the amount on each piece of first-class mail that it makes on a piece of advertising material, or what we call standard mail. So the situation in some sense is worse for the Postal Service on the revenue side than even the 22% number suggests. But the 22% number, let's keep in mind, we haven't seen drops in mail volumes of that magnitude since the Great Depression. So we're dealing with very severe revenue side problems with the Postal Service.
And what you're saying is that, yes, we're still getting mail delivered, but the post office, because it's not first-class mail the way it used to be, the post office can't make the kind of money it was making in the past?
Well, that's right, Marty. The types of mail, and I think the listeners know if they look at their own, the composition of the mail that they receive is a lot of business-originated material. There's a lot of catalogs, credit card advertisements, and all of these things are fine. In fact, about 90% of all the mail volume now originates with business, so it's really commercial material. The Postal Service provides those big mailers that do catalogs and advertisements with steep discounts because they do things like pre-sort the mail down in some cases to the carrier route so that the carrier just has to deliver the mail in the order that the advertiser gives it to the Postal Service. They also so do things like drop shipping where the mailer will actually deliver the mail to a point closer to the route for the Postal Service. Those discounts mean that the Postal Service makes less money on each piece of that advertising material than it does on the old holiday card or utility bill that we used to mail in.
Well, Steve, let me go back to you and talk about another, I guess, threat to the U.S. Postal Service, and this is things like FedEx and UPS that are involved in a lot of delivery of packages. How much has that eaten into the USPS?
It's eaten in a great deal. You know, the Postal Service, once upon a time, basically had more or less complete monopoly of things, and FedEx and UPS have really eaten into a lot of their business, package business. I should say that the Postal Service does actually deliver a lot of items for UPS and FedEx, because the Postal Service has to go to, all these routes every day, 250,000 different routes every day, and UPS and FedEx don't go to every little nook and cranny of the nation. For many rural places, they actually have the Postal Service carry the mail for them for that final mile, and it pays the Postal Service to do that. It's, it's very expensive to cover 250,000 routes all around the nation. A big disadvantage that the Postal Service has is that, its labor costs eat up a higher percentage of its overall cost than is the case for UPS and FedEx. At the Postal Service, 80% of its costs are labor costs. At UPS, 53% of the costs are labor costs. And at FedEx, which spends a lot of money ferrying packages around by airplane, but at FedEx, labor costs represent just 32% of its overall costs. And critics of the Postal Service say, you guys really, really have swollen labor costs, and you really have to bring them down a lot. And the Postal Service says, wait a second, we're much more labor-intensive than UPS or FedEx because, we have to cover all these routes. Unlike them, we have, 6-day delivery. Okay, yes, you can get a package delivered by FedEx on a Saturday, but it'll cost you an extra $30. Mm-hmm. And I think the Postal Service says, we'd love to get $30 for each delivery. Each delivery we do on Saturday.
A kind of an apples and oranges situation. Rick Eddies, let me go back to you, and this gets us into the weeds, but these are important weeds to understand. Back in 2006, Congress passed a law requiring the Postal Service to fully fund health benefits for future retirees. And October 1st was a deadline for the Postal Service to make another payment into this fund of $5.5 billion. They were hoping, or I guess the head of the Postal Service was hoping to not pay that money. As I understand it, Congress decided not to reduce that payment. As I said, this gets us into the weeds. But nonetheless, how much do you think this really hampers the Postal Service, that they have to pre-fund retirement benefits for future retirees?
I think it's important to take a look at that, Marty. And I think part of the motivation for the 2006 Act was the unfunded taxpayer liabilities that the Postal Service has incurred since it was created in 1970. And according to an April 2010 report by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, which I happen to have in front of me, their estimate of the total unfunded taxpayer liabilities for the Postal Service is about $88 billion, or it was about $88 billion as of April 2010. So a lot of that is unfunded retiree health care costs. That's the biggest fraction of the $88 billion. Now, the Postal Service has paid down some of that since this report was issued. So let's say it's maybe $75 billion left. But in terms of a taxpayer accounting, we have to keep in mind that there are still these unfunded liabilities that the Postal Service has incurred that are either going to be paid by mailers through the Postal Service, or they're going to be paid by taxpayers down the road. So I think most of us would like the taxpayers to be protected from these liabilities and for those to be paid by mailers through the Postal Service. So the Postal Service missing this $5.5 billion payment on September 30th, and Congress did defer that payment until November 18th, that's a big issue that the the Postal Service needs to address, I think.
Well, and as I said, this gets us into the weeds. But, Steve, I was also reading that the Office of Personnel Management and another, I guess, regulatory commission, this is actually quoting from the New York Times, saying that the Postal Service has been overpaying into this fund. Have you looked at this, and can you come to some kind of conclusion?
I've looked at it somewhat. I imagine Professor Geddes has looked at it more closely. First, on the pensions, you know, several independent actuaries have concluded that the Postal Service has overpaid. Estimates go from $50 billion to $75 billion into two different pension funds since 1970s. And the Postal Service is saying, well, one way to solve our financial crisis, and it had a deficit of about $9.5 billion in the fiscal year that just ended on September 30th. So it has revenues of about $75 billion and a deficit of around $10 billion, which is a very high deficit percentage of overall revenues. So they're saying we want to be able to claw back some of the extra pension money we paid in, and they want to use that money to help pay off this $5.5 billion a year they owe for retiree health care. I should add, Marty, that a lot of defenders of the Postal Service, you know, especially the unions, who are very much against the Postal Service's plans to trim the workforce by 220,000, 120,000 by layoffs, 100,000 by attrition, they say what's really killing the post office now is that since this Congress passed the law in 2006, the post office has to kick in $5.5 billion a year to fund retiree health care. And that's they say that's a totally unrealistic amount, and it's really squeezing, smashing the Postal Service because it comes at the same time as the horrible 2007, 2008, 2009 recession. And they want that number, the $5.5 billion number, you know, greatly reduced so that the annual obligation for future retiree health care is much smaller. Another point they make is the 2006 law requires the Postal Service to prepay in 10 years all its theoretical retiree health care obligations for the next 75 years. And you know, the unions say that's a huge burden. It really has, has cost the Postal Service $20 billion, in $22 billion in payments the past 4 years, which it says that equals the Postal Service's deficit over that, those 4 years. I think the union's a little simplistic because there are other things that are really causing the Postal Service's deficit, as well as Professor Geddes explained, that you know volume is falling very, very quickly. Well, so there are these long-term obligations, and it's one of the hardest things is to figure out how they're going to pay for them and how soon, how rapidly the Postal Service will have to pay them down.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, and we are talking about the future of the U.S. Postal Service. The voice you just heard is Stephen Greenhouse. He's the labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times, wrote a book called The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Also with us is Richard Geddes. He's an associate professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell University. He wrote a book called Saving the Mail, How to Solve the Problems of the U.S. Postal Service, and we want to hear from you. Can the U.S. Postal Service be saved? Should it be modernized, privatized, reformed? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Early breast cancer detection means better outcomes. The Women's Cancer Center at Fox Chase offers a full array of risk assessment and screening options, including genetic counseling. From October 20th through the 30th, the PA Breast Cancer Coalition's traveling photo exhibit, 67 Women, 67 Counties, Facing Breast Cancer in Pennsylvania, is on display for public viewing. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
We want it to be loose because anything could happen. We don't rehearse, you know. We have to believe in what the other guy's going to do and make it work.
on canvas, in the pocket band.
Tomorrow night at 10 on WHYY-TV.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Beethoven's Seventh Symphony has endured for almost two centuries. The Philadelphia Orchestra under Charles Dutoit performs Beethoven's Seventh, plus the Violin Concerto of Sibelius with Julian Rachlin. For your Beethoven tickets, 215-893-1999, online at philorg.org. October 14th, 15th, and 16th at the Kimmel Center, Dutoit conducts Beethoven's Seventh with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We are talking about the U.S. Postal Service, which has been losing money and losing customers. And again, our guests are Richard Geddes and Stephen Greenhouse. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Rick, let me go back to you and something that the Postmaster General said last week, and he has said this before, ending Saturday delivery, laying off something like 100,000 workers, and then, of course, others that would be let go in a sense once they retire, and then closing as many as 3,700 post offices. What would ending Saturday delivery do for the post office? Would it help?
Well, there's some debate about that, Marty, and I think that it would help. People generally believe it would save the Postal Service about $2 billion a year. And of course, there would be environmental benefits associated with not having to run the trucks around all the routes 6 days a week. The Postal Service has been asking Congress for the right to do this for years. And I think this gets us to a deeper issue, Marty, which is I don't really blame the Postal Service itself for any of the financial difficulties that it's currently facing. I think the managers at the Postal Service are doing the best possible job they can given the constraints that Congress has placed upon them. But I think Congress is placing them in an unrealistic position, and Congress excessively meddles in what are fundamentally business decisions about the U.S. Postal Service.
No, that's okay. Give us an example of that. How do you see Congress meddling?
Well, I see Congress meddles in the sense that obviously we all know the story. The writing is on the wall. People are using email, electronic document delivery, much more than they have in the past, and doing more shopping online. So all of that is reducing the volumes that the Postal Service gets. But so the Postal Service needs to essentially downsize and streamline its distribution network. They have over 300 very large sorting centers, which are way under capacity, many of which they would like to close. But it's very difficult for them, politically speaking, to do that. Again, they've asked for reducing Saturday delivery, and Congress has pushed back on that. So I believe that we're at a fundamental point here where we need to make a decision about whether the Postal Service is going to continue to be politically manipulated in this way, or if the Postal Service is going to be freed to operate like a real business, which I think is what some people at the Postal Service would like to do themselves.
Well, let me go back.
Can I just add one or two things?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead, Steve.
When I did a few big stories for the New York Times on the Postal Service, you know, one complaint I heard was that, you know, Congress, as I said, often intervenes, and the Postal Service is barred by law, passed by Congress, you know, from increasing the price of postal stamps more than inflation. And, you know, when volume drops and your costs in many ways, you know, remain the same, or the price carrying per letter increase because you're not carrying as much mail, you might want to raise your prices, but they're really barred by Congress from doing that. Second, on Saturday delivery, I interviewed the esteemed senator from Maine, Susan Collins, who's one of the two or three most knowledgeable members of the Senate on postal affairs, and she is very much against getting rid of Saturday delivery. She says, yes, it might save the Postal Service around $2 billion, as the professor says, but she says a big advantage the Postal Service faces now over United Postal Service and FedEx is they have Saturday delivery, and is it worth giving up, she says, you know, 17% of your weekly service and a big advantage over your competitors by relinquishing, by ending Saturday service. And she also said, you know, I have a lot of constituents who live in these small towns, who live in these islands off of Maine, and if they don't have Saturday delivery, it's going to be very hard for them to get their newspapers, many of them rely on getting prescriptions through the mail. And Senator Collins said, what happens if you have a three-day weekend? Someone might not be able to get any mail, for like 4 days, and that could be a major inconvenience, she said, for someone, waiting for that prescription to arrive, or someone who can't get a newspaper for a few days. I'm all for people getting as many newspapers as possible, of course.
Of course. Well, but let me go back to something that John Potter said last week, and this is to you, Rick Geddes, and he said that he would like to at least consider the thought of the post office selling products and services, maybe things like insurance or banking, cell phone services. I know that this happens in some European countries. Is that even on the table for discussion, or is Congress an impediment to that as well, Rick?
Well, this is exactly the issue, Marty. The Postal Service has talked about getting into other product lines for a long time. Now they're talking about getting into delivery of beer and wine.
Right.
I think that would be fine. I like beer and wine. But if the bigger question is, why do we want to have a government-owned monopoly firm in order to ensure the delivery of what is now 90% commercial material and the delivery of beer and wine? Why do we need the government to intervene in what is now a fundamentally commercial service? In other words, have we gotten to the point where now the nature of the mail has changed? And something Mr. Greenhouse said is actually very profound, because the original notion of the post office binding the nation together was very important in that it subsidized the delivery of newspapers to frontier states using higher prices from the delivery of letters in eastern cities. So this was literally a way of making frontier states feel like they were part of a broader union. I think it served an important public purpose at that time. The question is, what is the public purpose that is now served by a government-owned monopoly at a time when 90% of the mail is catalogs and credit card advertisements, and they're interested in getting into delivering beer and wine and these other products that you mentioned? So I think this is a decision point for us.
But does whatever happens to the post office, Steve, though, does it raise questions about what happens to people who live in rural parts of this country, and whether private companies want to deliver out there, and whether they can deliver at an affordable price? I'm thinking about the fact that I can send a letter to an Indian reservation at the bottom of the Grand Canyon for 44 cents. In a world that's privatized, is that even possible to contemplate?
Would you like me to comment?
Well, actually,
Steve.
I'll toss it to Steve, and then I'll get it to you.
A first-class letter from where you are in Philadelphia to the Grand Canyon probably costs more than 44. You know, the real cost is cost the Postal Service more than 44 cents, even though it will cost the sender only 44 cents. Mm-hmm. So it is a loss. I think one thing many listeners don't realize is that the Postal Service doesn't get any direct money from the federal government. And postal officials say, we're really not subsidized. We're not getting, money earmarked to us from the government. Now, I was out researching a story in some rural towns that face post office closings, and they say, this is terrible. They want to close our post office. Since the founding of the nation, the U.S. has guaranteed us universal service, and now they want to close our post office, and many people say, look, in towns of 100, 200 people, it just isn't smart, it just isn't economic to keep having a postal service with a full-time postmaster general. They say it only makes sense. And these people say, the United States gives wonderful subsidies to high-tech businesses, to oil companies. Maybe they should start giving at least small subsidies to the postal service to ensure continued, not service, but to make sure that the post offices, these little post offices, continue in thousands of small towns across the country. As you said in your introduction, Marty, the Postal Service has warned 3,700 towns in all 50 states that it might close their post offices, and a lot of people are extremely unhappy about that.
Rick, you want to wait? Yeah, go ahead.
Could I comment on that,
please, Marty? Please do. No, go ahead.
I agree entirely with Mr. Greenhouse, and I think that there are a number of issues and services that Congress might want to provide through the Postal Service. And Mr. Greenhouse mentioned perhaps elderly people in rural areas who receive prescriptions by mail and wouldn't be able to get those, and delivering to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and perhaps preserving some rural post offices because of the tradition. I think those are fine. But what I would like is two things. First of all, is any subsidies that are required to provide those social services are transparent. So they're not provided just through the Postal Service. Generally, they are provided explicitly for those services that Congress designates as being public services. And second, that those subsidies are provided at least cost. So if there's a rural route that wouldn't be served for a profit-maximizing firm where there's elderly people who need their prescriptions, that you bid that route out so that you get the lowest cost provider. Perhaps that would be a subsidy to FedEx or United Parcel Service or directly to the Postal Service. But what I would like to see is that subsidy being provided transparently and with a very clear public purpose, which is perhaps to provide service to rural areas. I think part of the problem now is that Congress says these things are good, but the subsidies are not transparent to the taxpayer, and they're not provided at low cost, at the lowest cost, through some sort of competitive bidding, although we keep in mind that the Postal Service already bids out a lot of rural routes to rural carriers. We see the people in their pickup truck with a U.S. mail sign on a rural route. Those routes are already bid out.
Well, we are talking about the U.S. Postal Service, its future, and some of the challenges that it faces. Richard Geddes is an associate professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell University. Stephen Greenhouse is the labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times. Both of them joining us today on Radio Times, and we want to hear from you. What do you think should be done to modernize or perhaps even reform the U.S. Postal Service? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get some callers in on the conversation. It looks like we have Jennifer from Roxborough joining us on Radio Times. Jennifer, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Hi Marty. Great show. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was just wanting to comment. You know, I really miss, you know, getting things in the mail, my personal items in the mail, and it's just one of those things that's changed over the years. I mean, I miss birthday cards. I get birthday greetings on Facebook from my friends, but the tangible card, you know, I love Christmas cards, and things along those lines. And I just, you know, it's just funny that I don't, you know, I like the idea of paying my bills through the mail because I can time them to when something is going to hit, you know, hit my bank account. And, you know, and I did find some old letters recently, and they're 20 years old, but I could read them. I don't imagine being able to do that with emails.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And what we hear, Steve, is both a bit of, you know, nostalgia for the days of letters in the mail. But obviously, people can still do that. But nonetheless, I think many more people are deciding to use the Internet for various correspondence, bill paying, all of that.
Yes. During this big Senate hearing the day after Labor Day on the future of the Postal Service and, you know, the worry that the Postal Service might run out of money next year and might even have to close unless Congress takes some action to save it, you know, some senators said, well, we really, really, really have to persuade Americans to start using first-class mail more. And they said, some of the greatest books in history are based on letters from presidents, letters from soldiers overseas. And they say, you know, people, you know, should go back and write more letters and send more Christmas cards and send out more invitations and write more love letters. And it's a wonderful romantic notion. But in this age of the Internet and we're all getting, you know, 200, 300, 400 emails a day, you know, I don't really see lots of Americans saying, okay, I'm going to spend a lot more time, grabbing my pen, sitting down at my desk, lighting a candle and writing, you know, romantic letters.
Now you really are getting nostalgic.
And it's a wonderful idea, and you know, I often think that when I really sit down and write a handwritten letter, it's more thoughtful, composed, more carefully than when I'm typing at 80 words a minute on email. But I think it's just a dream to think that we could really have a big increase again in first-class mail because it's
like the good old days. Well, Rick, let me go back to you. And as you look into the future, what do you then imagine with the U.S. Postal Service? Do you imagine a more sort of private-public partnership when it comes to delivering mail and packages?
Absolutely, Marty. I think that's a terrific way to put it. I imagine the Postal Service. So we have to keep in mind that the Postal Service is the result of a major change in what used to be the post office. We always used to call it the post office, and it was the post office until July 1st of 1971, when the 1970 Postal Reorganization Act came into effect, and the post office ceased to exist. So my point is that this entity that we're now calling the Postal Service has gone through major changes in the history of the United States to adapt to new circumstances. The 1970 Act was one attempt by Congress to make it more operate in a more business-like fashion, to improve its accounting. And I think the Postal Service has done a terrific job of breaking even over time, which is a sort of like a private business, but is a requirement of the 1970 Act. The Postal Service subjects itself to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which is reporting requirements that private firms have to adhere to. So what I envision is, you know, Congress eventually letting go of this and saying, we don't want to provide taxpayer subsidies as far as the eye can see. We just want this to operate like a private business. That means subjecting it to the competition of the market and structuring it like a private law corporation and eventually privatizing the firm and having it be another delivery firm. I happen to think that what Mr. Greenhouse said about the Postal Service delivering the last mile to all addresses is an enormously valuable distribution network. It's already partnering with United Parcel Service and particularly with Federal Express, and it does a great job of delivering that material that last mile. So I think this could be a profitable, viable business where Congress could contract with that in, as you say, a public-private partnership to provide particular special public services like delivery of those prescriptions. So that's my vision.
I hear you. And see if we have about a minute before a second break here, but you mentioned the fact that for FedEx and for UPS, they spend a lot less for salaries and for benefits compared to the U.S. Postal Service. Looking into the future, does that mean people delivering our mail will be making less money, do you think? And this is for Steve. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, sorry. And Professor Geddes, please follow me. So, you know, less money, perhaps not, Marty, but clearly the Postal Service is going to try to, you know, squeeze down costs, and it's gotten its two major unions to agree to a pay freeze for a year or two. And also, it does have a two-tier wage contract, as is the case, you know, with GM and Chrysler and Ford in Detroit, where the new wave of workers, there aren't that many really new wave of workers at the Postal Service, but the new wave earn 10% and in theory will permanently earn 10% less than the permanent workers. And then, you know, Professor Geddes mentioned all these contract workers who are working for the Postal Service. An increasing percentage of the Postal Service's workers are kind of contract workers, and generally their wages and benefits are not as good as the more permanent unionized employees. And the unions, you know, you could bet your bottom dollar, they're going to fight as hard as they can to make sure that they get good raises and maintain their good benefits.
And hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a very short break. Steve Greenhouse and Rick Geddes, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about the future of the U.S. Postal Service. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Westtown School. Since 1799, Westtown has invited students pre-K through 12th grade to pursue a global education, one that helps prepare them not only for college and career, but also for life. Parents who want challenging academics and character development for their child can learn more by attending Westtown's lower and middle school open house Monday, October 10th at 8:30 a.m. Details at westtown.edu.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The construction industry made up 5% of American jobs, but 20% of all jobs lost in the recession. We'll see how that industry is faring. Also, teaching foreign doctors about Midwest culture in order to better treat patients. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Lancaster City Arts is proud to support WHYY. Lancaster City Arts, 125 art venues, all within one walkable community. From galleries, art studios, museums, and an art college, to music, poetry, dance, photography, professional theater, and symphony, it's an opportunity to experience something different in an art scene that's quite unexpected itself. Lancaster City Arts. The journey starts online at lancasterarts.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The amount of first-class mail has dropped dramatically in the last few years as more people use the Internet, and that has left the U.S. Postal Service in dire straits, raising questions about its future. We're talking about whether the U.S. Postal Service can be saved, reformed, the role of privatization. And our guests are the New York Times' Steve Greenhouse, author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, and Cornell's Richard Getty. And he's the author of Saving the Mail, How to Solve the Problems of the U.S. Postal Service. And we have one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Rick, it sounds like you wanted to weigh in on the salaries or wages and benefits for postal workers.
Yes, thanks, Marty. Thanks for following up on that.
Sure.
I did. I just basically wanted to reiterate Mr. Greenhouse's point. I think most people realize that jobs at you were asking about what might happen if the Postal Service were operating in a more competitive environment, if it's dual monopolies, it actually has two monopolies, one over the delivery of anything considered to be a letter, defined as a letter. The other is actually over the use of your mailbox. It has an exclusive monopoly right to the use of your mailbox. If it were those monopolies were repealed, I believe that you would see jobs that are very similar to what we see at United Parcel Service and at Federal Express. I think people view those jobs as being good jobs, solid jobs, well-paying jobs with decent benefits. And, you know, the job of a UPS driver is a good one. And I think we would probably see jobs similar to that evolve in a more competitive postal service.
But it sounds like they would be paid less, but you're saying still a good job.
Yes. Yes, I think that's right. And statistical studies, if we want to go to the data, a number of studies that control for an employee's age, for their education, for their tenure on the job, show that a postal worker earns about 28% more than would their comparable private sector worker. So that 28% premium keeps popping up in a number of different careful empirical studies. And I think that you would probably see adjustments to the market, but these would still be good postal jobs, even in a privatized competitive postal service.
And what do you think a typical annual salary would be under those circumstances?
Oh, I would have to look into that, Marty. I'm afraid I don't know offhand, but I would look at comparables in other similar firms like United Parcel, DHL, and Federal Express. The other thing I think we should note that listeners should be aware of is that a number of other countries are way ahead of the U.S. on this. In fact, Germany privatized their postal service. They bought DHL a long time ago. Holland privatized a long time ago. And just this year, the United Kingdom passed their Postal Reform Act, which is going to privatize Royal Mail. So many other countries have moved farther along the reform route than has the United States.
And let me see what Rick from Orland has to say. And Rick, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to say that I am a 15-year postal worker. I'm in maintenance, and I'm 58 years old. If I am forced to retire at this point, at 58 years old, I'll collect a whopping $530 a month. I don't know where these people think that we get these fantastic benefits, but it's just not in my future. Out of that, I have to pay for medical insurance. So,
and Rick,
that's my comment.
No, don't leave us because I have a couple questions for you. I want to hear from our guests as well. Do you fear being laid off?
Absolutely.
because of all the talk about the state of the U.S. Postal Service?
Yeah, they're talking about consolidating or closing 250 processing centers, pushing back the standard delivery from 1 day to 2 day, which is what we've been working very hard to ensure that your mail gets there the next day. Now they're saying, well, that's not so important. 2 days, fine. And that would allow them to close a lot of facilities and ship the mail further to be processed.
Rick, you can answer this or not, but as you said, you've been working for the U.S. Postal Service for 15 years. What kind of money do you make?
Just about a little over $60,000 a year, and I'm an electronic technician. I have 40 years of experience in maintenance and 20 years of experience with electronics, and they may be referring to clerks and carriers being overpaid, but I believe that the highly skilled maintenance staff and engineers and technicians are about par or underpaid.
Well, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. Let me give Steve Greenhouse a chance to respond. And Steve, you wrote a book called The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. We heard from Rick making about $60,000 a year, worried that he's going to be laid off. Can you just respond to his concerns?
Sure. I interviewed a lot of people at the working in the Postal Service who said one of the reasons they went to work there 10 and 20 and 25 years ago was it seemed like a very secure place to work. And now, for the first time, they're really worried about, massive layoffs. And one of the things that's sticking their craw right now is the two major labor unions there have negotiated contracts with no layoff clauses. And the Postal Service says our financial crisis is so bad, we need to lay off 100,000 people. And they've gone running to Congress and say, Congress, please pass this law to exempt us from this contract. And the unions say, wait, the U.S. Constitution bars the impairment, the invalidation of contracts, so they're saying that might raise constitutional issues. It's a big mess. But, what Rick says is true. A lot of postal workers are worried. They fear, that for the first time they might face layoffs. As to the, Professor Geddes says that, postal workers earn on average 28% more than comparable private sector workers. I think over the past 20, 30 years, we've really seen a decline in benefits for private sector workers. We've seen wages flat for private sector workers. And the postal unions say, a lot of our workers earn $35,000, $40,000, $45,000 a year. That doesn't make them rich. It earns them perhaps enough to support a family. And they worry that if they, start earning the $10 and $12 and $14 or $15 an hour that many private sector workers earn, that it's going to lead to kind of an impoverishment of many postal workers, and that it's going to really hurt the ability of many Americans to remain in the middle class. That's a major argument the postal unions make in response. Republican critics in Congress who say the postal workers are living high on the hog. They say, well, why then does 80% of the postal services costs go to labor when it's just 32% at FedEx.
Rick, weigh in on that, and then I want to get Sharon, another postal worker, to join us. But go ahead, Rick Geddes.
Yeah, I would like to quickly weigh in since the caller and I share the same first name.
Yes.
The point that he raises, I think, is an excellent one. And this is the point about privatizing the postal service or just realizing the value that is embedded in the Postal Service's distribution network, as well as in the enormous real estate holdings that the Postal Service currently has. If we were able to monetize or realize that value, we could include postal workers like Rick in giving them some of that value. And the payment, he mentioned $500 a month, I think. He could be given a much larger upfront payment as part of making the Postal Service into a private firm. In fact, that's what the Brits have done. And I think it's 10% of the value of Royal Mail has been set aside for Royal Mail workers. And so the privatization approach that I'm talking about could really help workers like Rick, who are concerned about the future and concerned about what that service of 15 years for the Postal Service will get them. So I think that value that they stand to gain should be kept in mind.
Let me get to Sharon from Michigan to join our conversation. And Sharon, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Yeah, I'm wondering why it's never mentioned that the pre-funded pension fund is used by Congress for many other things. I understand that they use it to balance their budget. It goes towards the workman's compensation for all federal employees.
Sharon, let me toss that to Steve Greenhouse, and this is something we were talking about earlier about this prepaying into the pension fund. Sharon is saying that it's used by the federal government for other services. Is she right, Steve?
Yes, you know, and I'm sure Professor Geddes knows more about this than I do. My sense is, the Postal Service is paying a lot of money into pension funds, workers' compensation funds, health care funds, and, I think Congress, the federal government, will spend some of that, but the important thing is that, that ultimately when the Postal Service has to make good on these pension and health care obligations, it will make sure that the money is there. So that's the important thing, that the federal government will honor those long-term commitments. And I'm sure Professor Geddes can who's more expert on this, can add to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm happy to weigh in on this, Marty, if that's okay.
Yeah, please go ahead.
So there are two retirement funds that we're dealing with. One is CSRS, which is the Civil Service Retirement System. The other is FERS, which is the Federal Employee Retirement System. Postal Service is involved with both of those. President Obama's Office of Personnel Management did a detailed study to try to resolve this issue of whether or not the Postal Service is paying too much into these funds. The Office of Personnel Management decided that the Postal Service is actually just about paying the right amount into CSRS. It's not overfunding that. But it is overfunding the FERS, and people generally agree on this number. It has overfunded FERS by about $7 billion. So there's about $7 billion, not this number of $75 billion or whatever is floated around by the Postal Service. The arbiter of this, the OPM, Office of Personnel Management, has decided that CSRS is just about right. And FERS, they have overpaid about $7 billion. I think it's important to keep in mind the April 2010 General Accountability Office's report on health care costs for employees, where they say it was about $88 billion of underfunding into that. So the Postal Service accounting and the 2006 Act have actually done a pretty decent job of funding these things. We do have that, that $7 billion that we could talk about. But I think that points to how poorly a lot of other entities within the federal government are doing in terms of pre-funding their retiree health care and pension costs. It's not that we want to make the Postal Service do less. It's that we would like to see the other entities in the federal government do as well as the Postal Service has, I believe.
Sharon, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what Sarah from, looks like Lansdowne, has to say. And Sarah, you're in Radio Times. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
I wanted to say that all I've heard about this discussion is whether the post office should be privatized or to have a public-private partnership, et cetera. And I think it's been mentioned that there are several countries around the world that have privatized their postal systems. But I think the discussion should go deeper than just about privatization, because around the world, even in countries where they have privatized postal systems, they are losing money due to the new paradigm shift for the virtual mail delivery across the world. So I think the analysis should go into what services and products are profitable, for whether it's a privatized system or not, I'd like to know if you have any working international models that we can learn from.
Rick Eddies, can I toss that to you?
Sure. I think and the caller is absolutely right that this trend of people using electronic communications, electronic document delivery, shopping online, I believe that's going to continue. So what we need is a structure that will allow this delivery system to adjust to the demand. The other alternative, I think, is untenable, is continued taxpayer subsidies. So you either reduce the costs as the demand falls, or you have taxpayer subsidies. There's no middle ground there. So I believe what we need is a flexible system that will allow the Postal Service to slowly contract as the demand for physical mail delivery falls. Now, regarding her second question about international experiences, I think we can learn a ton from other countries. The United States is way behind on this. For example, in Germany, I think they made a mistake in their approach in that they privatized before they got rid of the monopoly power. So I think the first thing you would want to do is get rid of the dual monopolies that the Postal Service has and make it subject to private corporate law prior to privatizing. So there's a number of other, we can look at examples in other countries. We can look at what the Brits have done and their current approach to privatizing Royal Mail, what's been done in New Zealand and Australia, for example. So I think she's right on that.
We're almost out of time here. Steve, some, I guess, 3,500 potential closures of some of these more rural post offices. But I was reading that about 2,500 of them are in Republican districts and about 1,000 in Democratic districts. Does that tell us that there's some politics involved in who's going to stay open and who's going to get closed?
I think there will be a good bit of politics. And as I said, I was visiting some small towns, and the people there say, why can't our congressman get more involved? Why can't he go to bat for us? I bet that, you know, they said, you know, congressmen in other towns and other areas will go to bat for their postal service, and that will make it easier to keep their postal services open. You know, Republicans, remember, often, you know, are certainly more free market, want less government than Democrats. And I think, on one hand, they want to sort of best for the constituents and keep their post offices open. But I think on the other hand, they're more eager to reduce government deficits, reduce the role of government, let the forces of the free market play. So I think they might be more hesitant to intervene. And the caller asked about why not probably maybe we, you know, the idea of privatizing the U.S. Postal Service. You know, it's interesting that Republicans who are interviewing privatizing many city and state services are really not yet talking about privatizing the U.S. Postal Service. And I think they realize there's something sacrosanct about the Postal Service, and there might be a big backlash against the idea of trying to privatize the Postal Service.
Well, on that note, we have to end our conversation. I thank you both for joining us today in Radio Times. Steve Greenhouse, thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. And he's the labor and workplace reporter for The New York Times, wrote a book called The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. Rick Geddes, thank you very much as well.
Thank you for inviting me back, Marty.
You're welcome. And Richard Geddes is an associate professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell University. He wrote a book called Saving the Mail, How to Solve the Problems of the U.S. Postal Service. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and send us an email. I guess you can also send us a letter as well while we are talking about the U.S. Postal Service. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.